Monster Man, special episode, The Doom Patrol. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Explosion. And Explosion asked me to talk about the Doom Patrol, a group of superheroes who you may know through their TV series. I guess that's on Stars in the US and on Stars in the UK. I've never seen the TV show, but I do know a fair amount about the Doom Patrol in the comics, and I'm going to take them as like a starting point to look at two different eras of the Doom Patrol and the two different approaches that those comics take to assembling their teams, and look at that in terms of monsters and also to some extent protagonists in fantasy role-playing games. If you'd like to be like Explosion and get your own special episode, remember that all you got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is the $2 reward, and which is approaching its 100th episode. So tons of stuff about religion and mythology and fantasy role-playing games for you to go and listen to as soon as you subscribe. All right, let's take a look. The original Doom Patrol was created in 1963 by writers Arnold Drake and Bob Haney and artist Bruno Premiani. The Doom Patrol are a group of misfit superheroes outcast by society, recruited by a wheelchair-using scientist to defend the world that rejects them. And if that sounds familiar to you, you may be surprised to hear that the Doom Patrol actually predates the X-Men and that there has been some controversy in the past over their similarities. Although I believe Arnold Drake has walked back his allegation that Stan Lee copied the X-Men from the Doom Patrol. Now, like any superhero team, the Doom Patrol have been canceled and revived many times over the years. And one of the things that they were most notable for is that when the book was originally canceled, the team were all killed. Now, except for two members who were not there at the time. But all the team who were in that issue were killed. I mean, they've all come back since because comic books, but, you know, this was meant to kind of firmly draw a line under it. And when the book was later revived, it was revived with a more or less new cast of characters. And so, like, as I say, like all comics, it's been canceled and revived and canceled and revived. There was a critically acclaimed 1990s run written by Grant Morrison with art by Richard Case. That was subsequently Rachel Pollack took over from Morrison. A more recent revival written by Gerard Way with art by Nick Darrington. And of course, there's the TV show. And there have been many other versions as well. I can think of at least three or four other attempts to revive the Doom Patrol. So the Doom Patrol is well-liked, but unlike something like the Justice League or the Fantastic Four, it has not run continuously since its inception. And yes, I know there was a brief period where the Fantastic Four was not being published. And actually, that's true of the Justice League as well. That, whatever. More or less continuously. The Doom Patrol is much more episodic. So because of time constraints, and because some of those revivals aren't very good, I'm looking at you, John Byrne, we're going to focus on the classic 60s team, and we're going to focus on the Morrison revival of the late 80s and early 90s. In both cases, I'm going to suggest that we might look at the Doom Patrol's villains as kind of equally instructive to the characters themselves. So let's start with the 1960s. The original Doom Patrol was led by the Chief, that's your scientist character, Niles Calder, and included Robot Man, a race car driver who was horribly injured in an accident and his brain was transferred to a robotic body. Negative Man, a pilot who fused with a negative energy being that could like leave his body and fly around and do stuff. And Elastigirl, a movie star who could grow real big. There are also two other members, Mento and Beast Boy, who are kind of on again, off again. Beast Boy went off and became a new Teen Titan later on, and I think he was out of the Doom Patrol at the end of the Doom Patrol run. So he's not like a core member. So the unifying principle of the Doom Patrol was that the characters were all people who sort of felt like their powers made them freaks, an idea that is pretty commonplace today, but was relatively rare in a DC comic in the 1960s. Typically, your DC superheroes, your Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and then your kind of lesser tier, Hawkman, Green Lantern, The Flash, were aspirational figures. You know, Clark Kent might have some exaggerated, like, woman trouble or whatever, but he was somebody that you would want to be. You know, even in his civilian life, he was a highly regarded, hardworking, socially responsible professional. Very much a pillar of society. But maybe as a reaction to the success of Marvel Comics, DC does kind of do this little weird wave in the early 1960s. So the Doom Patrol, obviously, but also like the Metal Men and another Bob Haney creation, Metamorpho, the Element Man. I should say Bob Haney. And did Ramona Fraiden do the art in those early Metamorpho comics? I want to say. So kind of like a little bit more experimental, a little weirder, like not the kind of like relatable humanity of like a Spider-Man comic, but also not the kind of upright pillar of society-iness of a Superman comic. Although Silver Age Superman, not necessarily like that either, actually. Silver Age Superman, a bit weird. But that's not what we're here to talk about. So I think that there was a desire to branch out into less conventional superhero storytelling in the 1960s. So you could argue that in this sense, the Doom Patrol characters are quote-unquote monsters. You know, a possessed man wrapped in bandages, a human brain and a robot body, a lady who can grow to huge size. Although, I do think that the kind of the conventions of superhero art do mean that Rita Farr is never really as monstrous as all that. Like, she can get real big, but she's still just a person who can get real big. She's meant to think that this is grotesque, but it never really plays because there are perfectly ordinary superheroes who have similar powers. And you can even see how this group could act as antagonists in the game, right? And the focus of this is their leader, the chief, you know, who's kind of the, like, stays at the base and gives the orders character. You know, over the years, writers have made the chief into a more sinister figure, ranging from being just a cynical manipulator who exploits his team's vulnerabilities to, in the 90s, I think in the Morrison run, he is revealed to have actually caused all these accidents, because all these people were, Cliff Steele was like a, you know, big shot race car driver, Larry Traynor was like a hot shot, overconfident pilot, Rita Farr was this vain actress, and he wanted to almost punish them by turning them into these things. And if you have a setting that is judgmental toward people who deviate from its norms or fearful of those people, like a Warhammer or a Ravenloft type of environment, then it's easy to see how people with paranormal abilities, especially people with paranormal abilities outside of like the conventional respectable mold of being, you know, a wizard where you got a you know, a certificate on the wall and a bubbling lab and everybody kind of knows what a wizard is, but then this person is a human brain in a metal body. What does he want? Will he destroy us? And you can see how then people who are sort of outcast from society in that way might be willing to do anything for the person who gave them shelter and supported them when nobody else would, even if what that person wanted was something evil. Especially if they didn't necessarily know that to begin with. So in this way, they make for fun antagonists, right? You got a group of agents for the bad guy, each of them unique powers, but their loyalty to the villain is based on a motivation that is itself sympathetic, even though this group are your opponents. They can either fulfill the role of kind of like the rival adventuring party, you know, so even that, like, the chief doesn't necessarily have to be a supervillain character. He could just be, you know, a rival wizard who also wants that same artifact in the dungeon and has sent the other adventuring party in. And this kind of like undercuts the usual things to make the other adventuring party the rich adventuring party or like the fancy Hollywood hotshot adventuring party while you're the scrappy underdogs. Whereas here you would be playing on the PC sympathy so that they actually quite like the rival adventuring party, but nonetheless, they have to be opposed to them. Alternatively, they could function in, like, I've mentioned before the idea from Knight's Black Agents of the conspiramid, the conspiracy pyramid, that kind of shows where, like, different tiers of baddies go. And, you know, under the very peak of the conspiramid, you have these kind of characterized individual villains. And I feel like Doom Patrol-like characters could fit into that slot really well because they're colorful and fun, but maybe they're not, other than the chief, they're not evil mastermind material. And of course, they have their own villains. So, you know, super teams often have enemy teams that are created almost like evil counterparts to them. You know, the Justice League have the Injustice Gang, the Avengers have the Masters of Evil, the Doom Patrol have the Brotherhood of Evil. And they were similarly a mishmash group of villainous characters led by a scientist type. Although in this case, the scientist is the Brain, who is just like a brain in a kind of skull-like jar thingy, and his assistants include a beret-wearing, machine-gun-wielding gorilla, Monsieur Mala. Though the 90s one were developed much more about the romantic relationship between the Brain and guerrilla assistant. Although, again, see, you have the same thing starting to apply to the Brotherhood of Evil, where they become more and more sympathetic. This is something that's going to happen to any character that people really like in comics, with the possible exception of Doctor Doom. Because the character is popular, people want to spend more time with them. And if you spend more time with them, then they can't just be a full-bore villain. They have to have more complexity to their motivations and personality, which means that the ranks of the kind of tweeners in the world of comics are populated with a lot better characters in general than the ranks of the absolutely pure villains, because that's how you get into tweener status. You know, ambiguous, maybe not totally a villains include, you know, like Magneto and Catwoman, and, you know, and only a handful of like real maniacs like Red Skull and the Joker are over in the bad guy, in the purely bad guy mode, right? The Riddler did a face turn for a while. So following the cancellation of the Doom Patrol series, the property lay fallow for a bit until there was an attempt to revive it in a series written by Paul Kupperberg, with art by a couple of different people, probably most notable for having art by a young Eric Larson. Kupperberg's run was not very successful, and it is astonishing actually to think that in the 80s it was possible to produce this kind of mediocre book about a property that there wasn't that much excitement about, and have it run for as long as it did, because Kupperberg's run went for like a year and a half. With they did a DC Showcase, I think the book was called, which is like a series of like little special issues. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, it was even longer than that, with no indication that anybody particularly cared about it. I mean, you'd get canceled like a shot under those circumstances today, if your book even came out in the first place. Kupperberg's failure ran longer than some books that are successes today. The marketplace just really changed. Kupperberg attempted to make the group into more of a conventional superhero team, and characters who were introduced in this run, like Tempest and Celsius, have pretty like conventional superhero conflicts. Now, part of that is because the sort of conventions of superhero storytelling had moved up toward where the Drake, Haney, Premiani, Doom Patrol had always been. So characters who were conflicted about their own powers were sort of old hat at this point. So in 1989, Kupperberg was replaced with Grant Morrison, and art duties were taken over by Richard Case. What Morrison decided to do was, as near as I can reckon, I realize this was technically 1989, but Morrison's Doom Patrol is one of the 90s-est things there is. So I'm going to think of this all as part of the 90s broadly. What Morrison decided to do was do a book that was to the 90s as the 60s Doom Patrol had been to the 60s. So not to like recapitulate those 60s themes, but to take the same idea of like pushing the limits of how weird superhero storytelling could get and put that into the, you know, where those limits were in the time that that book was being made. This was total revamp of the book, and it succeeded in a lot of ways. You know, I think that this is a very like critically well-regarded thing. It blew a lot of teenage minds. I do think that sometimes there are elements of it that haven't aged well. So the handling of mental illness with the character of Crazy Jane, I think, is probably not how it would be done today. But I was thinking of this as like a recent run, and then I realized that that comic is 30 years old. Then I crumbled into mummy dust. Anyway, Morrison introduced a lot more obvious weirdness, even weird compared to the original Doom Patrol, including grotesque extra-dimensional entities like the Scissor Men, who kind of snip people out of reality, and absurd or surreal villains like the Brotherhood of Dada. The Brotherhood of Dada are really interesting, actually. They include weird characters like two-dimensional Mr. Nobody, there's Sleepwalk, whose powers only work while she's asleep, and there's The Quiz, a supervillain who has every superpower that you haven't thought of. I actually think that these are pretty gameable enemies, because like a lot of good supervillains, they have a very understandable weakness. So Sleepwalk is incredibly powerful. What you have to do is wake her up. You know, similarly, The Quiz, like if you want to fight The Quiz at the start of the round, you're just going like flight, super strength, invulnerability, laser eyes, you know, to make sure that you kind of tick off the things. So The Quiz then has to fight you with all kind of weird powers. Some of the other members of the Brotherhood of Dada are more conventional, but also the Brotherhood of Dada have like a motivation that's a little bit annoying in an RPG context, which is that they really just kind of want to like freak people out and mess things up. They don't have a conventional supervillain plan that like they would benefit from in any way. Although, as I've said, you get one of those villains, right? You get one person whose thing is something totally nonsensical. But the Brotherhood of Dada were super weird because they had to be in order to be weirder than the protagonists themselves. So Robot Man came back as kind of our relatable point of view character. The Chief came back. Apparently he was pretending to be dead. Negative Man was reimagined as Rebus, a multi-gendered spiritual entity that resulted from the fusion of Negative Man and a character called Eleanor Poole, who's a doctor. And this is also where you get a sentient neighborhood, Danny the Street. Maybe they're not less weird than their antagonists, actually, now that I think about it. Now, I don't think that the Doom Patrol in this context make necessarily very good antagonists, because one thing that the team is not during the Morrison run is highly motivated. A lot of the time, they are sort of wondering what they're doing there and why they should be involved, particularly Robot Man, who, as I said, is kind of the, like, when a brain in a robotic body is the relatable everyman on your team. Well, although I guess Robot Man's most obvious explicit, like, influence, apart from the Golden Age Robot Man, is the Thing, who is both the grumpy one who doesn't want to be there and the relatable everyman. So there, I don't think that the Morris and Doom Patrol make interesting antagonists as a group, because they lack the kind of clear motivation to fight somebody, because, of course, one of the things that the book is about is all this fighting really necessary? But I do think that there's a lot to pick from it, although, like a lot of comics that are very popular, the Morrison Doom Patrol run is a victim of its own success in terms of swiping from it. It's quite distinctive, and it's very well known. So if you swipe an element from it, there's a good chance that someone at your table is just going to be like, oh, that's from Morrison's Doom Patrol. And you can't just say, like, well, extra dimensional scissor guys who snip people out of reality so they no longer exist are a well-known literary trope, because they're not. You might not care about that, of course. I do like, now this is something we've talked about before. I wrote in my notes, Danny the Dungeon, which I think would be fun, right? Because Danny the Street, as I mentioned before, you know, sometimes goes up and down. In a later run, Danny the Street is reduced to merely being Danny the Brick. And then later on, I think in the Way Darrington run, we get Danny the World. So Danny is a sentient place. And we've talked about that in dungeon terms. I do like the idea of a dungeon consciousness that is not necessarily like some primordial force of evil, like it's just this person, but at the same time, it is a dungeon, it's going to do dungeon stuff. Or perhaps it's even being held against its will, you know? Danny the Dungeon doesn't want to crush you with a death trap, but as long as the Witch Empress has her hands on the rod of dungeon control, well, that's where we are. You know, sorry pal, smush. I think there's maybe something to run with there. More interesting, I think, is the extent to which, you know, one of the things, the thread that runs through Grant Morrison's comics, well, one of the many threads that runs through Grant Morrison's comics, is they're very interested in the nature of comics as an art form, right? So this is most obvious in Morrison's run on Animal Man, where, you know, Buddy Animal Man meets his creator, Grant Morrison, which John Ostrander then turned into a great joke that we just can't go into. I'm sorry, I keep getting sidetracked because, like, the late 80s and early 90s is kind of like my peak comic book reading period, right? This is when I was like 11 to 14. So I have a lot of like little trivia memories of this time. I did not read the Grant Morrison Doom Patrol when it came out, though. I did read a few issues of the Copperberg run and decided it wasn't very good, correctly, but then didn't notice when the book just totally changed into something completely different. So I think that you could have characters whose abilities, like, in some way manipulate the game. That kind of, like, metatextual interaction is something that you find a lot in the Doom Patrol. Even the idea of, like, snipping people out of reality, you know, so you could absolutely have a character whose power was, like, they would roll a die on your character sheet, and whatever ability it landed on, they would be reduced by that much, or something like that, right? That is based on something that does not exist within the imaginary world of the game, but absolutely exists within the real world of the game, you know, or a power that hits only miniatures that have yellow on them, or something like that. I do think that there is something to be said for that. Again, you know, I was gonna say in a more conventional D&D game that might not fly, but actually there is a certain amount of this kind of shenanigan in classic D&D. I think the difference is the self-awareness of it, and I think There are definitely players for whom escapism is such an important goal that the last thing they like is to be reminded that they're in a game. I actually am a little bit like this. It depends on the game, but there are definitely games that when I'm playing them, I hate like pop culture references or similar kind of bits, you know, particularly characters who are a joke about something that characters in the world ought to know about. It seems a little bit, I don't want to say disrespectful, but maybe in some ways I'm a bit middle-fashioned as a gamer. I don't mind the setting being funny, but I don't like it when people make fun of the setting. Anyway, so I think you would, again, it's a question of you needing to judge your table. I do think that it could be fun to have a scenario where what was happening was kind of like the breakdown of reality, which is another recurring theme of the Morrison run on the Doom Patrol. You know, reality is breaking down, and part of that means that the normal operations of cause and effect, i.e. the rules of the game, are ceasing to function normally. You know, so you might find yourself in a world where all your bonuses are now penalties. You know, all your, you know, D4s are now D20s, and all your D20s are now D4s or whatever. I think there's something to that. I don't necessarily know that you want to go the full over the edge or 30, the John Wick game, where you emerge into the real world and confront your creators and ask them why they created you just to suffer, if for no other reason than that it's been done. So I think that the 60s Doom Patrol offers a lot of inspiration for creating memorable antagonists, particularly because, you know, what seemed wild and boundary pushing in 1963 is like curious in 2021, but not exactly gonna break your game. Sympathetic villains are not groundbreaking new tech, but I do think that this idea of kind of outcastness is a very sympathetic motivation, and it's nice to have antagonists at a mid-level. And I feel like the Doom Patrol-based or even like Brotherhood of Dada-based antagonists could fit into that mid-level where, like, obviously you have to beat them, you have to get the blue jewel before they do, you know, you have to stop them, but you might have second thoughts about just killing them. And they might have second thoughts about just killing you, which also lets you have lots of fun with the things that these characters can use their abilities to do. I think that, like, Brotherhood of Dada-like weird powers often go really well with characters who are meant to have an aspect of the unreal, so fae characters or characters from other planes. A lot of other planes are kind of conceptually rooted, so it sort of makes sense that characters could have conceptual superpowers. You know, you only have spells that nobody knows about, so as soon as someone names the spell, you no longer have it, or something like that. I think that there is some value there. You know, and in that way, the Doom Patrol are, because they're sort of flawed heroes, they're much easier to turn into antagonists than another superhero team, right? When the Fantastic Four become villains, like in Planetary, they have to be made really pretty evil, whereas you can see more Doom Patrol-like antagonists kind of functioning as ham and eggers. They were not super powerful superheroes to begin with, right? You don't have to worry about fighting Superman. Robot Man is very strong, but he's not, like, turn the world backwards strong. So I think that they fulfill an interesting slot, right? A good mid-range identifiable antagonist with enough of a personality that they're fun to roleplay with is a thing that is desirable. And you then have, you know, you can choose the option of also calls into question the structure of role-playing games in general, which is your kind of Morrison run. I have not read enough of any of the later runs to really comment on them. I read a little bit of the Way Darrington run, but not enough that I could say anything useful about it. And anyway, we're pretty much out of time to talk about turning classic superhero teams for certain values of classic superhero and team into quote-unquote monsters for fantasy gaming. And I think it works a little better than I anticipated. So, Explosion, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Explosion and get your own special episode, remember, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we'll be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So I hope that you'll join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.